Welcome to the Ask an Expert podcast, hosted by Joshua Carlson, co-founder of the award-winning direct marketing agency, Propello Media. Ask an Expert is a show of candid conversations with proven business and thought leaders, talking about real problems, and more importantly, about real solutions you can use to benefit your own business. We hope you enjoy the honest and organic nature of each guest's conversation. So let's jump right in.
When asked in front of a live audience how he could help his company provide Ritz-Carlton experience, today's Ask an Expert simply stated they needed to make sure that every single one of their employees had an opportunity to stay at the Ritz. And while that may have made the CFO's stomach churn, the CEO reported 6 months later that it was having a tremendously positive effect on their overall customer experience. Hi, I'm Joshua Carlson, co-founder of Propello Media, and today I sit down with Joey Coleman. He's had an illustrious career, including a pit stop at the White House. And while we'll touch on that momentarily, the main reason we're having him on is he founded and leads a company called Design Symphony that's helping companies across the country improve their own customer experience. Today, he's going to give you actionable ways that you can accurately evaluate your current customer experience and then how you can begin to implement change. Now, let's hear what Joey has to say. Joey, welcome to Ask an Expert.
Hey, thanks, Joshua. Super excited to be here.
All right. So I'm really interested and fascinated by your background. And I'm actually, usually I just dictate these, but I'm gonna read this one off. So country kid, artist, singer, lawyer, professor, board member, author, speaker, business owner of Design Symphony, which we'll get into in a little bit. And if we're painting a background on a canvas, a little stint with Secret Service as well as the CIA. So this is quite the colorful background. The leading question now is, where did you end up with the customer experience? Like, where? How did this all drive towards this customer experience?
Yeah, so you're right. It's certainly an eclectic path, to say the least, or at least that's how I position it. Some people are like, can he hold a job? but the reality is, every job I've ever had, I left that job not because I didn't like that job anymore, but because I saw a new opportunity that seemed more interesting. Okay. So that has led me through a variety of careers that, as you list them out like that, you're right, it's pretty disparate and kind of all over the places, from things that are very, you know, right brain creative, like singer, artist, et cetera, to things that are traditionally seen as very more left brained activities, like being an attorney. The common thread that connects all of it answers your question, and that is, in each of those positions, the way one succeeds is by having a keen understanding of the human condition. Mm-hmm. Why do people do the things they do, and what can we do to convince, persuade, encourage them to do the things we'd like them to do? Sure. So when I was a criminal defense lawyer, how can I convince the jury to find my guy not guilty? When I was running a promotional products business, how can I convince people, because they get a squeeze ball at a trade show, to come check out a website? Yeah. When I was teaching, how can I convince my students to actually do the homework assignment every week? You know, so in each of those worlds, it was about persuasion, it was about positioning, it was about the experience you were creating resulting in a certain level of human behavior and human performance. And so that's the thread that ties them all together. And it just happens to have alighted at this point in my career on, okay, every business has customers. What are we doing to create the kind of experiences for our customers that will keep coming back for more?
Okay, so let's talk about this and keep coming back for more. You've got this kind of 100-day benchmark. Where did the 100-day benchmark come from? Tell them what that's about.
Yeah, so the principle is that the first 100 days are the most important time period in the entire life cycle of the customer relationship. Okay. And it's not just me that has that opinion. This research has been proven time and time again, locally, regionally, nationally, internationally. And the research is really staggering in the sense that across all industries, product and service, international, domestic, online, offline, product and service, you name it, somewhere between 20 and 70% of new customers will decide to stop doing business with you before the 100-day anniversary.
Okay.
20 to 70% leave. And what I found staggering is that most businesses are over-indexing on customer acquisition. They're focused on how do we fill the funnel, how do we get more, how do we grow, as opposed to how do we keep the people that already said they want to do in business with us.
Right.
When I present these statistics to the typical consulting client or audience that I have giving a speech, they look at that and they're like, oh, well, those sound staggering. And I'm like, yeah, well, what are yours? What are your stats? And most companies have no idea. And then they dig into it and they realize, oh my gosh, we're in this band. And if anything was bleeding out 20 to 70% of your business every 3 months, as a general rule, you should be paying attention to it if you want to be in business a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. So that's where it comes from. And the genesis of it coming in, to be candid, was a number of different things. Okay. You know, I read a report that was all about bank customers and that 32% of new bank accounts are closed before the 1 year anniversary and that 16% of those are closed in the first 100 days. And I thought, oh my gosh, bankers who usually, as a general rule, pay attention to the bottom line, 16% leaving in the first 100 days, that's staggering. I was running an ad agency where our job was to drive as much traffic to the front door, and we did a multi-million dollar for a campaign and they signed up a bunch of new accounts. And when I came back 6 months later, they had only kept a fraction of them. And we had a conversation and I was like, did we get you the wrong people? Was it a lead gen problem that we just brought in the wrong people? Right. Like, no, they were the right people. We just couldn't keep them. And by the way, a lot of the people we lost are people that we'd had for years and years and years that we're losing. And so we dissected and we looked at it and we're like, oh my gosh, there are operational structural problems here with the onboarding process and the continuing to maintain remarkable customer experiences after someone's gone through the grace period of the first 100 days. So the first 100 days is important. We want to focus on it, but you're not done at day 101. It just means hopefully you've laid a foundation that you can build on going forward.
Okay. So, well, you've written the book and I see it behind you. So nice product placement. But
I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. How to never lose a customer again. So let's talk about, you know, let's talk about the 100 days and then let's talk about it further. But like, what are some of the staples that we need to be focused on as businesses as we are onboarding a customer?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Number one, I think the most important thing holistically that we need to remember is that while we're celebrating that the deal is done, we're high-fiving, we've landed the new client, bells are being run, someone's winning a trip to Napa, whatever it may be, at the client, they're doubting the relationship. They are in buyer's remorse. Now, what's interesting is we've all heard of the phrase buyer's remorse.
Yeah.
But if I were to ask the typical person watching this video or, you know, listening to our conversation, do you have a system and a process in your business to address buyer's remorse?
Right.
Most businesses don't.
Yeah.
Well, we address buyer's remorse by delivering the product, by delivering the service. I'm like, no, that doesn't address the buyer's remorse. That's just the next thing that you do. Like, let's not pretend that that's actually addressing the issue. I believe that customers have the potential to go through eight phases in a journey. The typical business is paying attention to maybe three or four of those. And so there's a missed opportunity to acknowledge where is the customer in their life cycle journey with us. Emotionally, what are they feeling? Mm-hmm. Cognitively, what are they wanting? And what are we doing to deliver an experience during that phase that answers what they want, what they hope, what they dream, what they need, so that we can move them to the next phase.
Sure. So I think the default here is that, hey, if I do have a great product, if I do have a great service, it does satisfy that need. But it sounds like what you're saying is there's a gap in that from, yeah, that's part of it, right? We do need to focus and we do need to make sure that that product is good. But it sounds like there's a communication element that is really, we have to be either asking questions or we have to be communicating in ways. So what are some of those attributes that, that you can share?
Well, I think there'd be, let's take some examples from our personal life to hopefully ground these ethereal conversations in the reality of being a customer. You know, how often do we buy a product that we have great intention for this product and then we never use it?
Right.
Like the typical American has clothes in their closet that still have the tags on them. Now, is that the fault of the person that made the shirt? Or is it the fault of the person who bought the shirt, or is it no one's fault, but a lack of communication? How often do you buy a product or a service that the person you bought it from comes back to you, not the day you received it and said, so what'd you think? Well, you read a review on Amazon, but instead comes back a month later and says, hey, are you using it? Are there any issues? Are there any problems? How many times do we buy a product or sign up for a service that there gets to be a problem, but we are so not interested in reaching out to say, hey, it doesn't work anymore, or hey, there's a problem, we just throw it away or we cancel the subscription when there would have been an opportunity to save us.
Right.
But if they don't seem interested in whether we're getting use and enjoyment out of the product or service, why should I be the one that has to tell you? Right. And so yep. I think there's an opportunity, to your point, not only for outbound communication, but more importantly, I think a communication loop that continues with the customer. You know, we're all about prospecting. We're all about, hey, let's check in and see. Do you need us now? Do you need us now? Oh, you need us now. Great. Sign on the contract. Great. Cue tumbleweed. Yeah. Like they never hear from you again. It's like once you become a customer, in most businesses, you end up being treated worse than if you were a prospect.
Right.
That doesn't make sense logically. We don't like it when it happens to us. And yet so many businesses are structured that way organizationally and operationally to have the experience get worse once you actually become a customer.
Right. Yeah, I know I've been a part of those businesses where you hear the customer call you and like, hey, why is this prospect that I know getting treated better than I am as a customer? And it's a valid question. So I think this leads me to my next one, which is how do we evaluate our current customer experience accurately? And I put emphasis on the word accurately because I think when I was thinking this originally, I was like, okay, how do we evaluate? And I'm like, no, how do we evaluate accurately what our current customer experience is?
I think we have to be really clear by asking ourselves, are we generally honest with ourselves or not? Mm-hmm. At the risk of getting too psychological in this answer, I think often businesses don't want to recognize or acknowledge where the problems are. There are very few businesses that I go in where I would say in a workshop setting, great, we're going to make a list of the 10 biggest problems customers have. Just shout them out. I'll write them on the wall. That my arm doesn't fall off from getting tired.
Right.
It's not that the organization doesn't know what the issues are.
Okay.
It's usually that they're not doing anything about them. Now, occasionally there are issues, or we take the top level issue and we say, well, that's the issue, when the reality is we needed to dive a level or two beneath it. But I think a couple of practical ways we can evaluate is, number one, to say, when's the last time you did a customer journey map? And you actually sat down with pen and paper or a dry erase board, not on a computer. I'd say this respectfully to the online mapping tools. Do it physically. Get a kinesthetic experience from this. And map out from the moment someone first learns about you to their 1-year anniversary of being a customer.
Okay.
What are all the interactions, the sales calls, the marketing messages, the newsletters, the phone calls, the using your product or service, the invoicing, all the little touch points? Literally map it out on a wall.
Yep.
And then step back and say, what is our initial gut read on this? Are we overwhelmed? Is there a ton of communication? Are we embarrassed by the lack of communication? Is
right.
it somewhere in between? Is there a lot of communication at the beginning and then it goes dormant? Or is there a lot of communication in the sales process, then nothing until there's a problem? And then we put a lot of effort and communication on the problem. And then the second that's solved, we go back to cue tumbleweed. There's nothing happening. You know, what's the reality? The other practical thing I would encourage folks to do is get your newer employees involved in this. Mm-hmm. Because lots of times newer employees will say, why is it that we have one website where we deliver the service, but a separate website with a separate login and password for them to pay their monthly bill?
Right.
With all due respect to the IT department and the people who are legacy, they'll say, well, you don't understand. Did you do? But a new person looks at that and goes, that's just dumb.
Right.
What are we thinking? So sometimes getting a new face in the room really helps you to identify that. Last question is, when's the last, or the last practical idea for kind of how do you assess what the journey is are you actually asking your customers?
Mm.
And I don't mean the standard survey of, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely would you be to refer us to another friend or colleague in your industry, right? Okay, thanks right. for asking the net promoter score question. I get it. By the way, all your customers get it now. Yep. And they know that if they put lower than a 7, you're probably going to call them. So they'll just put a 7, even though their answer is 4, because right. they like to like not have you call them again. But what can you do to actually get them in the room and say, well, walk me through it. What, you know, let's, how are we doing? Oh, Joshua says, Joey, we're doing great. Okay, fantastic, Joshua. If there were 3 things, and you had to say 3, that you could wave a magic wand and it would change about our interaction, what are those 3 things? By the way, the reason I ask for 3 is not because there's always 3. It's because I want them to have to think. Number one, they could say, oh, well, I'd love it if we paid less. Thank you. There's a pricing conversation we can have, but I don't get a lot of data from that. Right. Number two, I'd like it if you were easier to reach. Oh, what do you mean by that? Well, I'd like it if, you know, we could reach you guys in a way other than an email. Oh, a light bulb goes off. They think the only way they can reach us is by email. When we have all this money invested in social, we have this money invested in phone numbers, we have this, you know, all these communications. Oh, what is it that we failed on explaining to them all the ways?
Right.
And then they'll say the third one. And I don't know what the third one is, Joshua, but the third one's the one you want to pay attention to. Because if they've had to dig this deep to get to it, chances are now we're at gold. Now we're at something that is speaking more specifically to what their pain point, what the relationship is. And if you can fix that one, 9 times out of 10, that's enough to get a renewal or another purchase.
Sure.
Because now they've said, hey, here's my problem. You've said, oh, here's my solution.
Right.
And you fix the problem. Well, now they're like, oh, when I say things, things happen. Maybe I should tell them the other 5 things I have a problem with, you right. know? And now we're off to the races.
Okay. So I like this concept and I like the little hack of doing 3, right? It gets them to expose the golden nugget. And I also like the hack of, you know, it's something I've definitely utilized before, which is new employees, fresh set of eyes. They really do kind of approach it as an actual customer and gets out of the bias that we inherently develop that calcifies over the years of being in the
business. Totally. I mean, how many businesses, Joshua, in this time that we're recording this said, well, there's no way we could do all of our work online. We got to be in person in front of the customer. Really? Because the last 6 months have kind of shown that when you couldn't be in person in front of them, did your business grind to a halt? Now, some businesses it did.
Sure.
But I've watched a lot of businesses pivot to, we're not going to fly someone to the other side of the country to have a 30-minute meeting. We're going to do a 30-minute Zoom call. And they still landed the deal.
Correct.
I'm not saying that we should go only to virtual, only to remote interactions. What I am saying is how many people had that preconceived, calcified notion that it couldn't be done any other way. And when their hand was forced globally by a pandemic, suddenly IT could figure out how to give everybody remote access from home.
Correct.
When before they said that was a huge security threat. Something to think about.
Correct. And so I think, you know, this is an interesting time because this hand has been forced upon us, right?
Yeah.
But what I love about the approach that you're taking is you can use information to move a direction. But one of the things that I've noticed within organizations is people making decisions are too far removed from that information. So I'm curious from a philosophical standpoint, and actually not philosophical, an execution standpoint, how often do you recommend that senior management and even the CEO be calling these customers to be having these, hey, what are your top 3 issue conversations?
Yeah, I would say at baseline minimum 1 hour every month.
Okay.
Minimum. That's the ante up chips to be able to call yourself remotely in touch.
Okay.
And when I say an hour, I don't mean an hour every month that is the scripted, you go on the sales call with the top salesperson to the top account. Right. I mean an hour of randos. Here's how I would explain that.
Okay.
You mentioned earlier I had this eclectic career path. One of the stints I had was in the general counsel's office in the White House during the Clinton administration.
Okay.
Now, before anybody gets antsy and starts tuning in or tuning out because I just identified the administration, let's be candid. I was a lawyer and there were some legal issues. So it
was
an exciting place to work, right? An exciting time. My boss on the very first day said, Joey, here's the thing. I have as a general rule only one requirement for your time here.
Okay.
I'm a young kid. I'm like, oh, what's it going to be? He said, we have this thing called the White House Hotline. Mm-hmm. It's a phone number that's published around the country that any citizen can call in and tell the president what their concern is, what their issue, what their topic is. Said you're required to man that hotline for 1 hour every month. And I said to him, I was like, okay, and I'm eager. I'm like, all right, Mark, I'll do that. But out of curiosity, why? Like, I'm going to do it. I'm not questioning the assignment. I want to understand, though, why.
Right.
Like, are legal issues coming in that you want us to be aware of? He's like, no. I want you to realize what an honor it is to serve the citizens of this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I realized in that moment, I thought my job was so important doing the legal work for the president. No, my job was important because this was the White House and I had a responsibility to the citizens to make sure that I was not so distant from their reality.
Right.
And I think the same holds true in your question for senior management. We get so caught up that we lose the understanding of the reality of what our customers are dealing with.
Right.
One my buddy, I have a podcast and my co-host used to be in charge of customer loyalty for Discover Card.
Okay.
And he said when he first went to Discover Card, he signed up for a credit card. Not the employee one, not anything. Yeah. He went through the process of signing up for a credit card so that he could see what are the hoops we're asking people to jump through. Right. Is the approval process easy? Is it online? How many questions they have to answer? How quickly do they find out? Are they happy with the credit amount they get? Are they unhappy? Is there a mechanism for them telling us this? Do they understand the point structure? Like all these things that were a presumed obvious given his role,
yep.
He wanted to see as a brand new employee what it looked like. So I would suggest anybody in a senior management role, are you actually a customer of your product?
Right.
And if you're not, ask yourself why.
Yeah. I mean, as a business, we should be in the business of serving customers. And this opens up a question I hadn't even thought before the interview. But since anything is fair game.
Anything's fair game. That's one of the rules I set before we started.
I know.
I said to Joshua, I was like, look, I have only one rule for these interviews. You can ask anything you want. I'm going to do my best to answer it honestly.
Yeah. Just like Mark had one rule in the White House. This is Joey's one
exactly.
rule. So let's talk about customers because I have inherently, my father owns his own business. My mother owned her own business, sole proprietor, kind of, small mom and pop shops, but nonetheless grew up in that environment. And I realized how important and how much work went into the customer. So let's talk about the customer versus publicly traded companies where the customer is the shareholder. That is an interesting split and fork in the road.
Huge. Yeah, totally. And I think what we're seeing in our society is there's been a shift in the last year. And I'm going to climb up on a little soapbox just for a bit, Joshua. And if you need to knock me off it, do at any point. Okay.
Hands ready.
Here's the challenge. We've evolved from the small mom and pop shops that were operating locally. Okay. Where you had to take care of your customer because if you were offensive to Miss Betty, she would tell her five friends and suddenly your little general store that you were operating didn't work anymore. Right. As time grew and we went from being local to regional to statewide to national to international, right. It became easier to not be attentive to the customer because we'd just go find another one because there were so many more. So it was acceptable almost to care less because we wouldn't feel the impact as greatly. Well, then we came along and we decided we're going to have publicly traded companies. So by the way, in the publicly traded company, the customer of the company is the customers, but the customer of the CEO is the shareholders.
Right.
And the CEO is going to be incentivized on what the shareholders say is important, even if that is in contravention to what the customers are saying is important.
Right.
This is why until very recently, Jeff Bezos and Amazon were not doing well on Wall Street. If you actually look at the history of Amazon, there were plenty of times where Wall Street was saying, this is ludicrous. Why are you investing to build warehouses? Why are you investing in trucks? This is stupid. Until a pandemic comes along and now everybody wants their stuff delivered at home because they don't want to go to a store. And right. Suddenly, all these investments that have been made over decade plus suddenly have more value. Where I see a shift happening is this was last fall, I believe, if I'm remembering the timeline. So about somewhere between 6 and 12 months ago, a group of companies came forward and said, we need to readjust the assessment, being that the shareholder value is the way we evaluate a corporation, and we need to include the customer value in our analysis. And there were a couple of big VC firms that said, if you don't put the customer first,
yep,
we are not going to fund you. When in doubt, Joshua, follow the money. When the money finally decides that this model over here is broken,
yep,
that's when we actually start to see change. And I don't say this to lambast the CEOs or the executive teams that have been doing this. This is the functional strategy that we set up in the United States for how we are going to incentivize our business leaders and reward them. It's, did you increase shareholder value? Even if that was the expense of the employees, the customers, the environment, everybody else.
Right.
Something for us to pay a little attention to, I think.
So I like that reference to pay attention to the money, because I think what happened with the, you know, and again, I'm a lay person, so by all means, you know, I don't know if I stayed at a Holiday Inn, so I feel entitled right now, but I think that there's short money and there's long money. And, you know, I think your Amazon example is a great, where, hey, they were really building an infrastructure of a completely different model that really did benefit the consumer. And, but that was a long-term play, right? How many head scratchers were there, but there was long money that was very keenly focused on, hey, what is this guy Bezos doing? What, this is very interesting. And one thing that I found, you know, you're like guest number 85 in 4 months, right? So we've done a lot of these. A theme that I keep hearing is the pandemic didn't change anything. It just accelerated things that were already starting to happen.
Agreed.
And fortunately, and I'm excited to have you on, the customer experience is one that has needed to change and has needed to evolve.
100%. I agree. I think the pandemic accelerated things, and it also magnified things. Yeah. You know, it took how you were as a human. You know, it's kind of like money. We come back to money again, right? People say, oh, well, that person, they suddenly won the lottery and they got all this money and they became completely stingy. No, they were always stingy. Or they won the lottery and they're just frivolous with their money. Look how quickly they're losing their money that they just won. Yeah, they were always like that. It's just right. You can see it easier when I put a magnifying glass on it.
Right.
I think the reality is, here in the United States, we have spent a lot of time as a country historically focused on the short term.
Yeah.
If we look at our country in the history of the globe, we are a teenager. And I don't say that being critical of teenagers, but I have a very different expectation set for a teenager than I do for somebody in their 40s or somebody in their 80s. The United States is a teenager. Let's go to Japan. Japan is a senior citizen.
Correct.
Not because the majority of people in Japan are older, which is a reality demographically.
Yeah.
But in Japan, you have 500-year business plans. Stop and think about that. If you're a corporation in Japan, you have a 500-year business plan. Most publicly traded companies in the United States, if I ask them what their 5-year plan is, it's maybe done at a strategic retreat where somebody wrote it down, but it won't ever be reviewed by anyone else again. It allowed them to check a box. There's not a lot of long-term thought in the corporate world in the United States, in the same way there is long-term thought in some of these other corporations that are operating around the world. Now, granted, when you're in a smash and grab, let's go get as much quick money as we can, you can build your coffers faster.
Yeah.
But you also burn faster and you burn out faster. So I do think there's something to be said that you know, this COVID-19 time has allowed us to do is just pump the brakes a little and really ask, is what I'm doing sustainable? I think what was magnified is how many businesses in this country were running in an unsustainable way. They were living month to month, handful to handful, you know, like a lot of citizens in this country. And I empathize with that and I feel it. The question is, as we start to move out of this and we think about the world we want to design going forward, is it worth putting a little more long-range planning? Or how about even just meet at mid-range? If you feel anxious about the 500-year plan, is it okay to ask for a 10-year plan?
Right.
Is it okay to think about, hey, what do I want to build that actually exists after I'm gone? So of your lifetime plan, how does that change your analysis of questions when you think about a longer time horizon to the finish line than this quarter.
Well, sage advice. I think 500 is probably a stretch for most of us, but there is a happy medium in there that certainly is past where they are at right now. I want to get back to, as we evaluate the customer experience, you gave some great ideas that we can do internally, you know, not just looking at it, but then, you know, going through it ourselves, but talking to customers. Most of the companies that I talk to don't do this at all. So if they're doing this now, right? If they've started this process, and let's say it's a 3 month, we'll just put a 3 month window on it. At the conclusion of 3 months, they've realized we see 17 things that are horrible. We see 10 that are critical, and we see 5 that are like we have to do immediately. Do you recommend businesses do all of the change and then go live, or do you recommend that they slowly implement change over time?
Yeah, it's tough to give a blanket answer to this, Joshua, because a lot of it depends on the culture. And it depends on both the expectations of the customers, but also the expectations of the employees in the organization. Sure. Some organizations, if you don't dot the I's and cross the T's before you roll it out, you're going to get fired. Other organizations are about, let's get it out, launch, launch, launch. Right. And if you don't launch immediately, you're going to get fired. So the self-preservation activities that occur within an organization greatly influence this answer. What I would encourage most organizations to do is to look at that list of things you've identified, mm-hmm. and don't do all of them immediately, because guess what? You'll never get them all done. Instead, pick the one or two that are causing the most pain for your customers, mm-hmm. and work on that. And pick the one or two that are causing the most pain for your employees, mm-hmm. and work on that. They're probably not the same thing. They might be, but they're probably not. Right. And I would work on both of those. I would also look at what is the thing that we can change today. And what is the thing that might take us 6 months of internal reorg and structure and building? And I do some of both. I do some things that are going to be low-hanging fruit, quick fixes, but don't only do those. Right. Build the muscle for doing the long-term change as well at the same time. But humans, we want the feeling of progress, but we also want the milestones, the wins, right? Sure. And so can you do a nice mix or a blend that gives you some of both?
Okay, so well, you open a door to something that I think is really interesting. And having worked in a number of different companies, I think your response is it depends is very, you know, paramount. But let's talk about the side of the house, which is the internal side of the house. You go into an organization and we say, hey, we go through whatever exercise we do and we determine we have these issues with customers. How do we get employee buy-in when a lot of what we maybe are doing is satisfactory and it's gotten us from, you know, it could be a 50-year-old company. We know there's plenty of those out there.
Sure.
But we wanna actually become a 500-year-old company. And in order to do that, we do have to evolve. How do we get employees to buy in and evolve with it?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Joshua, in the sense that one of the most common challenges that I hear from business leaders, whether it's a small mom and pop shop that's hiring their first few employees or the company that's been around for 50 years and has thousands of employees, is, you know, I'll regularly get a senior executive or a CEO or a business owner say, I want my employees to care as much about this business as I do. What do I have to do to get them to care as much about the business as I do? And most senior leaders and owners and CEOs usually get to a point where they just say, well, they're never going to care about it as much as I do. So what can I do to get them to care about it as much as possible? I think there's an underlying discussion here. Okay. And that underlying discussion is, do your employees feel like you care as much about them mm-hmm. as you're asking them to care about your customers?
Right.
And I hate to break it to anybody watching or listening, but the reality usually is no.
Correct.
Additionally, it is impossible to ask an employee to deliver a remarkable customer experience if they don't know what one is, if they have no context for it. So the typical customer experience in all of society, across all products, all services, is basically lying on the ground. it's bare minimum. We expect very little. When we go buy a product, when we go sign up for a service, we expect it to deliver most of what they said it would and not much more, right? Unless we're, you know, delusional and then we're like, we expect rainbows for everybody, you know, and we're quickly disappointed. What's interesting is, if I may, I'll tell a brief story, but I'll tell it quickly. I got asked to speak to a 200-person organization, and I was talking with the CEO, and he said, Joey, I want you to teach my people how to deliver Ritz-Carlton first-class white-glove service. I said, okay. He goes, Joey, it's really important. Ritz-Carlton first-class white-glove service. I said, I got it. I showed up for the day of the presentation. The CEO comes on to introduce me. Ladies and gentlemen, Joey Coleman, he's going to be teaching you today about Ritz-Carlton first-class white-glove service. Round of applause. I step on stage. I said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm so excited to be here. I'm going to begin by asking three questions. I'd like to ask a question. I'd like you to raise your hand if this applies to you. I know I'm asking for audience participation early on, but if you could humor me, join in. Let's see how we go. My first question, how many of you have ever spent the night at a Ritz-Carlton? The CEO proudly raised his hands. The head of sales raised her hand. The CFO raised his hand. And no one else in the room raised their hand. I said, fantastic. Second question, how many of you have ever flown first class? The CEO proudly raised his hand. The head of sales raised her hand. The CFO put her hand down and said, why would you pay more to get there 10 feet ahead of the next row? No one else raised their hand. I said, last question, by a show of hands, how many of you have ever eaten a meal where the waiter or the staff delivered your meal while wearing white gloves?
Right.
And no one raised their hand. And I turned to the CEO and I said, with all due respect, it is impossible to ask people to deliver a Ritz-Carlton first-class white-glove service if they have no context for what that means.
Right.
Most senior executives own luxury brands. They have had luxury experiences. They have stayed at the Ritz. They've flown first class. They've eaten at the Michelin-starred restaurant. Most of your staff hasn't.
Yep.
So it's impossible for you to ask them to deliver this bar that you've set of what you want to be if they don't know what that's like. So at that meeting, the CEO says and realizes in the moment, oh my God, what do we do now? And right. He says, Joey, can we amend the workshop? Right? Like on stage, live, this is happening. I said, absolutely. Where do you want to take it now? He's like, fix this problem. I said, are you sure you want me to fix the problem? He said, yeah. I said, okay, let's fix the problem. Ladies and gentlemen, how many of you have been here as an employee for longer than 1 year? 95% of the hands went up. I said, fantastic. We're implementing a new policy. On the anniversary of you having been here for a year, you and your significant other or spouse will get an all expenses paid trip to the Ritz-Carlton for the weekend, Friday and Saturday night. Now the CFO starts to have heart palpitations and is losing it. I said, bear with me. You just gave me permission to do this. I'm solving your problem. I said, and the crowd is going wild. People are like, oh my God. Somebody's like, my anniversary is next week. I'm like, you're going to the Ritz. This will be amazing. It's like an Oprah special, right? And you're a winner. And you're a winner. Cars for everyone. Everybody's excited. I said, but here's the thing. Let's everybody settle down a little. I said, the following Monday, you are required to give a 10-minute presentation to the company on what you learned and experienced in your stay at the Ritz with one idea of how we could give a Ritz-like experience here. Oh, okay. Said, great. Now, here's the thing. How many of you travel to see clients that requires you to fly? Almost every hand went up, the nature of their business. I said, great, here's the deal. How many of you usually get told you can only fly coach and that's what we're expensed? And every hand goes up. I said, great, here's the deal. Once a year, you get to fly first class. You get to pick which flight. You get to pick what timelines every year. Again, the CFO's like, oh my God, you're spending all our money. I was like, I get it, I get it. Same thing though, when you come back from the trip, you have to give a presentation.
Right.
And we rinse and repeat, we rinse and repeat. Fast forward about 6 months. I'm on the phone with the CEO. I was like, how are things going? He says, well, the CFO wants to kill you. I said, okay, I understand. I appreciate that. I said, but what's the reality? He said, Joey, we're delivering better experiences than ever before. Oh, and by the way, the CFO won't acknowledge this in a conversation with you, but will acknowledge it in a conversation with me. Our increased sales have paid for the Ritz-Carlton stays for the next decade.
Yeah. Yeah. Short money, long money.
Short money, long money. You got it.
Yeah. I love that story because it actually, it reminds me of a podcast that I heard where they talked about Airbnb when they were first starting out. They're struggling and they kind of had a brainstorming session where they sat down and they said, hey, how can we make this experience better? Right. And then they said, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. Now, how can we make it better? How can we make that better? Right. And they went through iteration after iteration. And I love the example you gave of not just letting them experience and not just providing a report on what they witnessed and what they felt and how it was, but then coming up with an idea for the business. Because I feel like this is what's missed. And I'm glad we started with, hey, let's identify problems that customers are facing today. But let's reimagine experiences that they haven't even thought they could have tomorrow, right? And so what are other ways, because that's to their CFO's point, that is a rather pricey and it's long money and I fully get it.
Sure.
But I imagine you have other exercises that you talk to companies about, like, hey, how do we reinvent, how do we rethink the customer experience?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a number of things we can do about reinventing the employee experience that lead to reinventing the customer experience. And there are also things we can do to involve the employees more in the customer experience we're creating. Okay. One of the challenges I think a lot of businesses face is the non-customer facing team members or employees feel a disconnect from the reality that is the customer life. We alluded to this earlier. Senior management feels that way often, but lots of times, you know, the accounting department or the maintenance crew or the operations team, they might not ever see a customer. And so what can we do to connect them to this customer experience?
Sure.
I think there are some, as a general rule, this is a sweeping stereotype coming up. Many sales departments are at an advantage in the sense that they are in front of prospects and customers on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And as a result, they have a decent read on what the realities are.
Sure.
What's working in the market, what's not working in the market, what people think. Why not bring every member of your team on a sales call? Mm-hmm. Like everyone. Yep. Wouldn't really cost you that much more, especially if you're driving to an appointment or even doing a Zoom call and you just said, hey, you know, I'm going to have this Zoom call with Joshua. Joshua, by the way, I'm going to invite Anna from our team to join for the call. She's new to the team. She just wants a chance to hang out with us and get to see you as well. And, you know, sure. Blah, blah, blah. And now we get almost this cross-training appreciation of what the connections are. And then we turn to Anna and we say, hey, Anna, how can I create more connection with Joshua? So one of the things I always used to do with my younger employees is I would invite them to come to the meetings and I would say, here's your assignment. I want you to watch the other person for the thing that I say that surprises them. Yeah. And I also want you to look around their space, their office that we're in, and identify three personal things about them mm-hmm. that you can observe based on what we see. And the employees, really? Yeah, that's your assignment. That's it. Everything else, I've got everything else. You just enjoy, but you have an assignment. We're going to walk out of this meeting. I'm going to ask you, what did I say that surprised them? Yeah. And what are three things you could observe? And so they come back and we would have a conversation and they might say, you know, oh, well, it was kind of curious that he has this collection of all of these cans in the background, right? You know, and then I would say, oh, what kind of cans were they? Well, they appeared to be beer cans. Are we sure? Yes, we are sure. No, we're not. Oh, then we need to pay attention to that next time or whatever it may be. And I would teach them to pull on the personal and emotional connection threads, because to me, that's the secret. The secret of creating a remarkable customer experience, the secret of creating a remarkable employee experience, is to strengthen the personal and emotional connection with the person that you're having a conversation with.
Right.
So you need to go beyond the, hey, we're checking the boxes for what they want in this business offering, or hey, we're delivering what we said we would. And instead, what is it that makes that person tick? Why do they believe what they believe?
Sure.
And what can we do to convince them to believe what we want them to believe or what we want them to do?
Well, I love the duality of it, that, you know, it's basically intertwined between the customer and the employee. And those experiences are, you know, very closely woven together. I want to shift gears a little bit. We're a marketing agency, so I want to shift this to marketing in a little bit. I'd like to just talk about the customer experience as it pertains to marketing pre and post purchase.
Love it, love it. Where specifically do you want to dive in somewhere? Do you want me to give some general observations and we'll go from there? What do you think?
I'll open it up to you, but I would say I feel like, and I'll use a conventional sales kind of stereotype, which is you have the sales department and you have the customer service department.
Sure.
The sales department, I need to close, right? So I'm going to say whatever fable I need to say in order to close. And the customer service department is on the other side going, I'm sorry, what fable were you told about? And I'm having to manage that. And I feel like marketing can be one and the same in that example, where how do we make sure that the marketing that we are putting out in front of the product or in front of the service really mirrors up to what it is that they're going to be getting? And then how do we maintain that, to your point? Getting them in the door is, you know, it's maybe that's step two, but there's, you know, step tens behind that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things we can do, and I appreciate the example. I think there's a question of philosophically, how should we think about this? And there's a question of tactically, what can we do to solve some of these problems?
Sure.
Let's take the philosophical side first, and then we'll dive tactically so we have some framework. I think philosophically, the reality is, as businesses grow and expand, our various departments become more siloed. Now, I grew up in a farming community in Iowa, and if you drive around farms, you see these giant grain silos. And let me tell you, silos are fantastic on a farm, and they are horrible in a business, okay? What's fascinating is if you spend enough time around a farm, you'll see that as the silos go up, eventually they create a bridge between the silos at the top.
Yeah.
Okay? Here's the thing. What are the bridges in your organization that allow people from marketing to actually have a relationship with the people in operations? Or is it that we're in our separate silos and they're the enemy and I don't want anything to do with them? They're either screwing it up or what are they doing, you know? Yep. And so I think, as I said earlier, those ride-along programs where have them come on the sale so they can experience, have the sales people. What's interesting is most businesses, when they develop a program like that, are like, great, all the ops people are coming out with the salespeople. Awesome. Now, when do the salespeople come off the road and spend a day sitting next to the ops person? Well, right. We can't do that. We'd lose so much business. Really? I'm starting to sense that maybe the sales team doesn't have an appreciation for just how hard the job is on the ops side or the account management side. So you've got to give people a better understanding of both sides of the puzzle. Quick story. I worked for a company years ago that sold home heating oil, and they were rolling out selling propane to residential customers. And we did this huge ad campaign. I was on the marketing side. We built out the ad campaign and everything that we were going to do, and we got the phones ringing. The goal was get the phones ringing so we could sell into this new program. And I decided after we built the campaign that for the first week, I would sit in the call center listening to calls just to see how things were going. And we had trained everybody, and we were like, oh, this is going to be great. I sit down and somebody calls in, and a call went something like this. Yeah, I saw your postcard about the propane. I'd love to get propane for my house. And the call center rep says, oh, really? And I'm sitting there going, oh, but I'm biting the insides of my cheek. Don't say anything, Joey. We're in listening mode. We're seeing how can we learn here. And the person goes, yeah, it seems like it's better for the environment. It's more cost effective. There's like a lot of positive reasons outlined here in the card. And I kid you not, the call center rep says, I just don't know if I'd feel comfortable with a giant tank of gas sitting next to my house like that. Like, have you ever seen in the movie when those things explode?
Oh.
I thought to myself, oh my God, we did everything we could. We had trained the people on the talking points and the script and everything was good, but we hadn't anticipated that the call center rep would bring to the table their life experience, i.e. via Hollywood,
right,
about how safe a propane tank was.
Right.
So how did we solve the problem? Well, everyone in the call center got a day off in the next 2 weeks to spend the day riding around with the propane install guys to see that it was safe, to have an appreciation for the coworkers on the other side of the house, and to understand that when we sold a propane account, we kept that other person employed. And so now it changed the conversation. So tactically, what are you doing to make sure that there's an understanding of all of the pieces of the puzzle of your operation? Now, when it comes to marketing, I think the secret is marketing usually devolves to a discussion of, should we be highlighting benefits or features? And that's the two things, benefits, features. And some people are like, features, features. Other people are like, benefits, benefits. I like to have our marketing give a preview of the experience of what it's like to be a customer.
Okay.
So if in our marketing, we're saying we're incredibly responsive. If you sign up for our service, we are Johnny on the spot. Everything is do-do-do. You can access us 24/7. Is the experience of being sold to a Johnny on the spot 24/7, we're there all the time?
Right.
We're not. If we're saying that the experience is, it's not going to feel like a number, does the salesperson treat me like that?
Right.
And when I get handed off to the account manager, does the salesperson come with me? Or does the salesperson go sell more accounts? Well, if I'm really not going to be treated like a number, the salesperson should continue to be responsible for the sales associated with my account, which is not how most businesses are structured.
Right.
Right? What are the internal operations? I've thought for years, and I've seen it with some of the most progressive companies, that what they do is they pay the salesperson a commission on the sale for the first sale. And then most businesses, that's the only commission they make. Any additional commissions goes to the account rep team or the account management team. What if the salesperson's commission grew every year that the customer stayed? Now, right now, the CFOs listening are freaking out. They're like, God, this guy loves to spend our money. But here's the thing. When you've been a customer for 10 years, every dollar you spend with us is more profitable than the dollar you spend in year one. Because we've recouped all our marketing costs. We've recouped our operational costs. You're probably on some level of autopilot. And we've probably deepened the relationship that the bill you're being charged now is greater than the previous bill, if nothing based on inflation alone.
Yeah.
Why can't a piece of that go to the salesperson? And what would it do to the salesperson's mentality if they realize that I'm not going for the short money commission this quarter, I'm going for a residual paycheck that'll be paying me a decade from now if I build my book of business? Right. Now, that's how most insurance salespeople operate. It's how most small business operators, but most large corporations don't do that. I would rather see a penny come out of the shareholders' quarterly earnings and divide that across all the salespeople to put it forward. Then what if we run it the other way? What if we said to the team that's going to be serving this account, hey, Joey, you're the account rep. Joshua's the salesperson. Okay, Joshua, who are you selling this week? What can I give you as an account rep that's ammunition for you to go out and make the sales you need to make? Because by the way, I'm incentivized on your closes too.
Right.
Wait a second. What? We're going to peel out of the salesperson's pocket some commission to go to the account rep and the account manager? No, we're going to add to the commission. We're not taking anything away. Don't touch the salespeople's commissions. They get very frustrated when you do that. We're going to create a new form of compensation for the marketing or for the account management team to make it part of it. So how can you get everybody incentivized? And it's not always about dollars. Too long, didn't read answer. Go read Dan Pink's book, Drive, and you'll realize that it's not just about the dollars. There's a lot of motivating factors there. Yeah. But what are we doing to just think differently in our businesses about the structures we've put in place that are actually causing our problems?
Yeah. No, 100%. That's fantastic. All right. I'm shifting gears again. I feel like I'm driving a car right now.
It feels like my career. Every time we get to it, 20 minutes on one thing, let's move to a new one.
Well, then it's synergistic. So I want to talk content. Specifically, you've written a book. You host a podcast. I'd like to just talk about, you run a business, right? And so there's an underlying theme that I've heard for over a decade. I've asked a lot of guests this that have done, delved into the content space. How did that come about, with the book and the podcast? How did it go from just being a concept to like, hey, we're actually doing this?
Yeah, kicking and screaming, basically. Okay. That how it came about.
Not uncommon.
Not uncommon, right? So here's the thing. I had wanted to write a book for a long time. like many people, I think, I wanted to make sure that the book I wrote was valuable. Sure. And so I wanted to spend all this time proving my thesis and proving everything in the world so that I had enough case studies that I could go write the book. Remember, I'm a recovering attorney, right? I'm a lawyer by trade. First step's admitting you have a problem. There's 11 steps after that. But I believe that if you're going to make a case before the court, you better have a lot of evidence. That's why my book has 46 case studies. The publisher was like, Joey, really? And I said, yeah. And they're like, we need to cut this down. This book is longer than we thought it was going to be. I said, great. You decide, you tell me which case study do you think we should cut? 2 weeks later, they came back and they said, okay, we've gotten permission to just print it at its length because we don't know which one we want to cut. And I was like, right. That's kind of my point. Not from a place of ego, but I wanted to answer all the objections.
Sure.
The tipping point was basically realizing that I was never going to be able to have as much impact with my message, only giving speeches and only working with private consulting clients, as I would writing a book.
Okay. I'll
give you an example. I got an email 2 weeks ago from somebody in Zimbabwe that said, Joey, I read your book. I loved your book. It's helping my business. The likelihood of me meeting that human being was infinitesimally small.
Yeah.
But with a book, they can access 20 plus years of life experience boiled down into a 340 page book that they can read, they can listen to on Audible, whatever it may be, that hopefully will help make an impact for them. So to me, it's getting to the point where you recognize that you have something of value to share, mm-hmm. and then recognizing that the delivery vehicle of a book or a podcast or some piece of content that you put in the world yep. is a really interesting way to increase your impact. The other interesting thing that comes from this is it increases your clarity, your own personal clarity. Nothing has helped shape and hone my thinking on customer experience more than writing a book about customer experience and having a podcast about customer experience, because I've got to be honing it. And I can't say the same, well, just take care of them and it'll be better for your business, right? Like that maybe works for the first episode,
but now
the second episode, people are like, Joey, I need more. And that's where, as you probably noticed in our conversations, I go back and forth between here's the philosophical big picture, here's the super tactical. Now let's get back to the big picture. Now let's get tactical. Now let's go over on a tangent here and talk about an employee experience. Now let's pull it back to customer experience.
Sure.
I mean, what are we doing? Creating content, I think, is a great lesson in learning about engagement. It's a great lesson in learning about what are you putting out there that resonates and recognizing that not everything will resonate with everyone. And that's okay. I'm the customer experience guy who has a book called Never Lose a Customer Again. And I will tell you, I don't want you to keep all your customers. Now, that's shocking to a lot of people. They're like, your book is called Never Lose a Customer Again. And you're saying lose some of them? I'm saying, no, I'm not saying lose them. I'm saying consciously decide to fire some of them.
Right.
Get rid of some of them, because creep is natural, right? Like people will come in that shouldn't be customers. People will come in who shouldn't be employees. What are you doing to increase your clarity, increase your impact by pruning the extraneous stuff that has a tendency, like barnacles, to get attached to a ship as it's trying to sail through the world?
Yeah, those are the ones where if we have a least favorite competitor, we upsell them on that company. Oh.
You know, our product, it works, but you know what it sounds like what we really need is our competitor's product. It's amazing. Go over there. That'd be great.
Exactly. Well, I like how you approached it. And I think philosophically, it is the right approach. And I think we can all get behind that, which is, hey, I want to create content that's meaningful. And I want to create content that's going to help people and make a difference. You've done that and you've put the book out, and let's put aside book sales, right? Because, you know, of course there's a byproduct to that, but let's just talk about what the book and the podcast has just done for your business. Because I've talked to a lot of business owners. Robert Glazer is one that comes to mind. He does this, right? So you're laughing.
Robert's a great, great guy. He's actually one of the case studies in my book. So I know Robert well.
Perfect. Well, Robert says, you know, hey, I'm sending out this email on Friday. It's going to my 30 employees, and I'm doing this for years and years, and then it's not Friday Forward, yes.
It's called Friday Forward. This is an advanced reader copy.
Okay, right? Well, I'm still waiting on mine, so I'm glad you got yours ahead of time.
Well, he was a case study in my book. I think he threw one to me early, so I appreciated it.
Okay. So there is a benefit to the business overall, and I'd just like to talk to you about what you have seen, whether it's through speaking engagements, clients that, you know, you never, to your point, I mean, Zimbabwe is about as far away as we can get kind of thing, but there's clients, you know, stateside here that you would never run into, and they would never run into you. So share what you've seen from that standpoint.
Yeah. So here, not that I haven't been real, but let me pull the curtain back and really expose the reality. I had a preconceived notion. My book came out about two and a half years ago in the first week of April. And I had this preconceived notion that the book was going to come out to much fanfare and success. We were going to hit list and the phone was going to start ringing and I was going to be drowning to keep up. The book came out the first week of April. We hit Wall Street Journal number 2. So I was like, that's a legit promoter of success. We're feeling good. In April, total new clients and new leads that came in from the book, 0. That's okay. It's April. People got to get the book. Then they got to read the book. May, 0. June, 0. July, 0. Now, Joshua, at this point, I'm sitting with my wife saying, honey, I'm sorry. We spent so much time and effort writing this book. I thought we had a good book. God, you edited the book. My wife's an amazing editor. I thought we were there. I don't know what happened. She's like, right. Just have faith. Just hang in there. August, 0. Middle of September, I get a phone call. Hey, so I read your book and I loved it. And then I gave it to my boss. And then about 2 months later, he finally had a chance to read it and he loved it. And then he gave it to his boss, who's the CEO. And the CEO, about a month later, finally had a chance to read it and he loved it. I'm calling to ask if you'll be the keynote speaker at our annual meeting. What I realized, Josh, was I had written a book for customer experience professionals.
Yep.
It spoke to the fact that in most organizations, they're siloed. In most organizations, they're the lowest paid, least paid attention to member of the team. And I hadn't stopped to think that if the vehicle for delivery is a book, number one, they need time to read the book. And number two, they need time to pass the book up the chain to the person who can actually stroke the check.
Right.
The phone started ringing in September. It hasn't stopped since.
Okay.
So the advice I would give is if you're creating a piece of content because you think it's going to make the phone ring, I would encourage you to stop seeing the world that way. It's like giving a gift with the idea of getting the thank you note.
Correct, right.
Don't give the gift if your goal is a thank you note. Stop that behavior, right? It's not about any one thing. It's about putting enough seeds in the ground, so to speak, or enough bread on the water that over time you become known for something, you have a reputation for something, and things can kind of filter up. I'd love to be able to give a more concrete answer. It's like, well, you do this and you do that, and then these are the results. I will tell you, and I say this not from a place of ego, we sold more copies of my book last month than any other month since the book came out.
Okay.
We're selling more copies each month.
Right.
Than previous month. I'm in this for the long haul. I'm playing the long game. If I was playing a short game, a book is not the way to go, right? In my opinion, a book is not the way to go because it's such a big requirement. It's one of the things I think is fascinating about Robert's book. Let's do a little visual here for those watching the video. And I say this respectfully, whose book's going to be quicker to read? Well, that would be Robert's.
Right.
Right. And it's full of value. It's got great value. I'm not denigrating the book. This is a harder book to write. Mark Twain said it best, I think. You know, I would have written you a shorter letter if I would have had more time.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. So as I think about additional pieces of content that I'm creating, I'm trying to create more snackable content that people can get a taste without creating what I call the appetizer effect, where all you ever do is have snacks. And you never have a meal of substance. It's very few people that I know where I say, tell me about the best meal you ever had. They say, let me tell you about the apps. And they stop at the appetizers. No, they talk about the main, the entree. But I can't get you to this entree if I don't give you some snacks along the way.
Correct.
Right? So to me, it's about what are you putting out there and what's your commitment? I think last thing I'll say on content, because you can tell I have some strong opinions on this. I am not the best when it comes to creating content. I will fully acknowledge that. If anybody who's watching you try to come see me on social media, you will see a complete lack of posting on my part. All right. It's something I've been working on and trying to get better at, but it's minimal compared to most. But what I do try to create is that if we're going to invest the time, I'm going to make this as meaningful as possible. So when somebody says, come on a podcast, I'm trying to bring all the thunder, all the energy for the full hour. And that's my content creation for the week. Instead of writing 38 Facebook posts, right? I'm just, it's how I'm hardwired, right? So it's easier for me to do this, but know what is best for you. If you're good at writing pithy little quotes and putting them on Facebook, write pithy quotes and put them on Facebook. If you're good at creating these, you know, white papers that are 10 pages long that break down it case study wise, great, go do that. Know what your skill is, dabble in other content forms, but keep coming back to the things where you know you can have the best impact and create the most value.
Well said. I think that's a perfect place to pause. And I do say pause because I'd love to actually have you back on in the future. This has been awesome. I really, really appreciate it, Joey. And I genuinely would love to have you back.
Well, thank you, Joshua. I really appreciate the invitation. I appreciate you having me. I appreciate everybody who's listened in and watched and been part of the conversation. And hopefully there was a nugget or two that'll help people enhance their customer experience, their employee experience, and maybe just think differently about the marketing they do and kind of the messaging they're putting out to the world.
I have no doubt. Hi, it's your host, Joshua Carlson, and I wanted to thank you for listening to today's show. This is the point where most shows ask you for a 5-star review, but we're not doing this for the accolades. Don't get me wrong, seeing 5 stars feels great, but our goal here is to provide real content from real experts that can meaningfully propel you and your business forward. So if there's something we fell short on, a question we missed, or if you just have any constructive feedback, go ahead and leave a review with your thoughts. We also enjoy hearing directly from our listeners, so look for our contact info via the show notes so we can connect one-on-one. We really do love the feedback so we can continue to improve and propel the show forward for you and all of our listeners.